Motopod, proudly supported by Roadskin, a UK label specializing in protective outerwear for motorcyclists. Modern biker clothing that you can wear all day long and engineered to save your skin. For the road, for life, visit roadskin.co.uk. To Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 774, the Saxon Ring, or Der Saxon Ring, as Bob Hayes would say, review. And of course, to review races, I need to have my co-host, because I'm Jim McDowell, and you can't have me doing this by myself. So we'll bring in, all the way across the pond, up late again tonight, a good evening to you, Richard. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. Thank you, Jim. Yeah, good evening, everybody. Good weekend of racing. One particular standout race, which we'll come to. So, yeah, looking forward to getting into the detail.
Yes, there is only one good race weekend from this weekend, and that's it. And, yeah. Anyway, well, so there were surprises in some of the other classes, I think.
There's plenty to talk about, but there was only one. For me, there was only one kind of really compelling race in the weekend.
Agreed. Okay, but before we do any of this, hey guys, we really want to thank the people who are helping to support the show with monetary donations. People like Gareth Locke, Jacob Newcow, Carl Hun, Rick Taylor, Nori Ito, Nick Saban, Alan Fleming, Brenton Edwards, Scott Baldwin, Ollie, Dennis Kingling, Jeremy Burnich, Jacob Rowler, Darren Andrews, Paul Lang, Gary Chavit, and Steve. It's with people like you that help us keep the lights on, help us get all the interviews that we've done so far this year. And every little bit helps. If you can help us out, it'd be greatly appreciated if you would go to our website, www.motopodcast.com. There are links for Patreon and PayPal, or you can go directly to Patreon, www.patreon.com/motopod, and you can donate for as little as $1 US, and every little bit is greatly appreciated. Those of you who can't, we understand, but hey, go to where you get your podcasts, give us a good rating, give us a 4-star or 5-star, whatever you feel. That'll help the algorithm switch us to back to the top so more people can find us. And again, all we want to do is be the best fan-based podcast for motorcycles that we can be. And with that, Rich, we had a great email from Gary. We teased everybody with this last week, and we've looked at it. It's a lengthy email. Gary, thank you for the rant. I loved everything in there. But Rich and I decided to pull out two pieces that we think that we would like to talk about a little bit. And who wants to go first, Rich, you or me?
You go first, Jim, because I know you're excited about this one.
All right.
Definitely in your wheelhouse.
Okay. So I will read the excerpt here from Gary's email to get us our start. He says, Fabio, Luca, and Zarco staying at Honda and Yamaha. Also, Pramac Yamaha. Yes, the bikes are shit this year. They might be worse than the European bikes next year, but this is Honda and Yamaha, for Christ's sakes. They've made a few championship bikes over the years. They know how to do it, and they will get their act together. When did Aprilia or KTM win a championship? I'm pretty confident that they will before the decade is out, but they haven't done so yet. Yes, Gary, I completely agree with you. Everybody wants to go down this path of like, wow, you got to avoid the European bikes. And you're correct. Think about all the championships that Honda has won. Think about all the championships that Yamaha have won. Okay, they know how to build a motorcycle, and they just have the sums wrong for right now, right? I think we've talked about this ad nauseum, I think, Rich. The Ducati is a package. Everything works together on that package. The ride heights, adjustments, all are integrated into the motorcycle as one unit from the ground up. They are not bolt-on add-in additions, just like the aerodynamics are not bolt-on add-in additions to it. These are all integrated systems that are working together. Okay. Let's face it, Yamaha has definitely found something with the motor. I think both Fabio and Rins like the new motor. It's got a little more grunt, a little more acceleration. They're getting better. They're getting closer. Okay. They're going to get there. Honda, they're still in the weeds, right? And I think I don't think Honda's exactly taking their eye off the ball, but look, we're at the end of 24 here. We're at the middle of 24. Let's call it that. And Honda's going to go back and they're going to be looking at the 27 rules. And I think Honda will straighten things out when we get to 27. I think what they're trying to do now is figure out how to make a very good handling chassis and how to make a good motor for what they have right now. And they're going to take that basis of that engine and put it into the 850. Because anytime there's a massive engine change, usually 90% of the time, Honda hits a nail on the head. I give you the V5 for the 990 era. I give you the counter rotating Big Bang motors that they had for the NSR 500s. They're the first ones to start running them in running the engine backwards. Essentially, if you're looking at the right-hand side of the motorcycle, the cranks would rotate towards the front wheel. Now they spin them back towards the other way. Even the four-strokes do this too, and they run that way. So I think Honda will get there, but it won't be until we get to 27. I mean, if you're thinking they're going to win a championship here in the last couple of years of this golden era of, rider gizmos, it's definitely not going to be. But I do think everybody is kind of getting themselves out of joint here that Honda and Yamaha aren't going to win championships anymore. If you don't think Yamaha isn't serious about going back and winning a championship, they would have not done a 7-year deal with Pramac to put two satellite bikes there for them, which are probably going to wind up being really close spec, a la Tech 3 and KTM with the gas. They're going to be really close to that spec. And I think that they're going to do pretty well with it. But have KTM or Aprilia won a world championship? Nope. Aprilia has won a lot of 250s and smaller bikes, right? They won 125s and won 250s to world championships. They never did win a 500 or a MotoGP title. But is that really because they didn't have a good biker, they didn't have a good rider? Or is it a mismanaged team? Or are they just lacking funds? I mean, I think of everybody, I think they're the smallest manufacturer that we have on the grid. So I'm not sure which one of those things are. I mean, I think what Aprilia has done is impressive. And given the fact that they got Martin on the bike next year, there's every possibility that that's the key that they're missing is a rider who's going to wring the absolute snot out of that bike to find every weakness. And if the guys in Noel can have a remedy for that weakness, there's no reason they can't win a championship next year. And the same thing could be said of KTM with Acosta. He has been the best of all the KTM riders all year long on a bike that I think we can all understand is definitely not right. And even Pit Beirer said this weekend at Sachsenring, hey, I can't remember. He wanted us to not take aim at the riders, but he wanted to defend. He wanted to defend his riders. Hey, we have lost something. We don't know what it is, but in this 3-week break, we're going to go figure out what it is, and we're going to get back to the performance level that we had at the beginning of the year. So let's just tone down the whole going to a Japanese manufacturer is a bad idea. So that's my take on what you had, Gary. Loved it. Rich, what was the piece that you picked out of Gary's email?
Well, I'm just going to say, it's just occurred to me, I've just written this down whilst you were talking, Jim, just on the Japanese thing, because it's kind of like fashion, you know, flares are in fashion one year and then they're out, you know, and then they come back again. So it's normal that you get these cycles of people that, you know, predominate over any sport, whether it's an individual or a team, whatever. For the Japanese factories, obviously we don't have Kawasaki anymore, but, and I would say Honda more than Yamaha, because Honda's a very, very, very big company, let's not forget. And that comes with certain limitations and problems. But it's kind of like the three C's, really, in terms of what I think has happened over the last, 5 years. I would say, and this is in no particular order, but COVID, culture, and a bit of complacency as well. I think those three things together, we know that COVID really impacted the Japanese because Japan's very far away and it's quite remote. The culture we know has, and this is the one thing I think we can see is changing dramatically, certainly within Yamaha, who are a bit ahead of Honda, but Honda are doing it as well. And then in terms of the complacency, what I mean by that is they had satellites, but they were very much third kind of cousins in terms of the machinery that they had. Whereas I think that's what the revolution that the Europeans brought, and obviously Ducati blazed the trail on this, is they had true satellite semi-works, if not almost fully works, bikes. And that data gathering clearly enabled them at a time of great innovation as well, with all of these gizmos. I mean, you called it a golden age. I think some people might take issue with that terminology, Jim, because I'm not sure that I'd necessarily think it is a golden age in the purest sense of the term, but it is prototype racing. As Alan was telling us, you know, some time ago when we had a subscribers chat, he was saying that it's a prototype championship, anything goes, and if it makes the bike faster, then, you know, it's good. And he's right on that front. But anyway, putting that to one side, I think the Japanese are suffering because they didn't use their satellites properly. Because to be honest with you, they didn't need to. And when Aprilia were running in GP500s, they had a triple, I think, didn't they, back at that time? Ironically, they were up against the might of Honda and Yamaha, and they just could not beat them at that stage, you know? So they kind of gave up in the end. So, and these, but these things come and go in waves and cycles and one thing and another. So I just think that's kind of where we are. And like you, Jim, I'm very convinced that, well, we can clearly see signs of progress at Yamaha. And I think the Honda are very sort of diligently testing away on various things, because of course the concessions rules as they exist now means that they can do almost not unlimited testing, but vastly more than most other teams. Yamaha are in the same position, of course. And I think by mid, or the sort of the mid part of the second part of the season, I think we'll see quite a lot of stuff come into Honda. And I just wonder if, without, it's not really a news item, so we're not going to kind of treat it as one, but the suggestion sounds to be that Joan Mir will stay put at HRC, which I certainly wasn't predicting to be happening. But I wonder if, A, he doesn't have that many other places to go that will pay him anything like the money that he's getting at HRC. And maybe he can start to see some of the stuff that's coming through in terms of cultural changes, personnel changes, equipment, etc. So I just think that's kind of where we are with things at the minute. But absolutely 100% for sure, Honda and Yamaha will be back. Whether it takes the 2027 regs for that to happen, maybe, maybe not. I think they'll probably make a bit of progress before that, but we'll see. Anyway, the other point that Gary made, which I just wanted to pick up on, was that Fabio too, ? And he says, no, not that one, the other one. So he's been talking about Fabio DiAntonio, the Italian Fabio. So practically every race he starts in the leading group, then slowly drops back like Miller, but with an Italian accent. Time management, ? But it happens to him in sprints also. Maybe he's allergic to collecting points. Despite showing flashes of brilliance, I can see why the teams are not falling over themselves to sign him. Now, I picked this one out because I kind of take issue a little bit with this one, if I'm honest, Gary. Although I take your point, but he is not on a 2024 spec Ducati. And I think what we saw with his kind of resurgence through last year really marked him out as a, he's not an alien. I mean, there's absolutely no way you could say that, but he's a real trier. And I actually think that he is either likely to stay put in the VR46 camp and possibly on the 2025 spec bike, because we know Marco Bezzecchi's going. And we don't know who else is going to be in that team, probably Morbidelli. So, okay, open question as to which one of them gets the 2025 bike. But I'm still holding on to the belief that I wouldn't be at all surprised if he doesn't end up on a works Yamaha contract in the new Pramac satellite setup. He hinted just after the Sachsenring that news is incoming probably within, I would imagine, within the next week or so, definitely before Silverstone happens, and we'll know where he's going to be. So I actually hold him in rather higher regard, I suppose, than you do, Gary, but I mean, we're all entitled to our opinions at the end of the day. But I think he's a very, very good rider. And I think he's one of those guys that went a bit under the radar in Moto2. And he took his time to find his feet in MotoGP. And he did it right at the very last moment. It's true. But that in of itself, that performance that he put in for that kind of crucial last moment at the end of last season, I think really kind of marked him out as a guy that's got a bit more about him than perhaps many people give him credit for. So I don't know what you think, Jim.
You know, I don't really know. There's that rumor floating around again, not news, it's a rumor that what Sergio Garcia and Ramirez, or not Ramirez, but Sergio Garcia and, oh gosh, who was it, are linked to those Yamaha rides in Pretty Mac. Who, I'm trying to think of who it was now.
There's been a lot of people.
Oh, Lopez and Garcia are linked to it. I don't know if that's true. It's a rumor, right? I could see Garcia getting there, but I don't think Primack wants two rookies to the class.
No,
unless Yamaha. Agree. But you know who? What? Who's is it? Is it Gonzalez or Lopez who has rides on the Yamaha VR46 squad Moto 2 bike? I can't think.
That was Gonzalez last year. He's actually on the Grassini bike.
Yeah, he moved to Grassini. But whoever's on that bike's probably got a shot at one of those seeds. So, I mean, I should know who it is, but I don't.
The other rider that keeps getting mentioned, but again, I would be, I mean, interestingly, Gary points out about, you know, hanging on to a rear tire. The other rider that's getting mentioned in the Pramac Yamaha conversation, of course, is Jack Miller. But I don't know. I mean, he's very, very experienced, but I would have thought that in a straight shootout, as the guy to go with, I would have thought Fabio Di Giantonio would get the nod over Jack. And I don't say that with any animosity or anything towards Jack Miller, because I love the guy. But I just think that Fabio would probably be the more sensible choice in that role, alongside a rookie, Jim, and Garcia or Lopez or Gonzalez. I mean, all of those guys would be very worthy of a move up to MotoGP.
Yeah.
We'll find out soon, hopefully. And certainly from the point of view of Digi Antonio, I think we're going to find out within a matter of, you know, a number of days, because that was the hint that went out on the socials.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with it. I mean, we're not there. We don't know the behind the scenes shuffling that's going on. And there could be extended things there. Miller, Digi Antonio, I mean, I think they both won probably close to the same amount of MotoGP races. But is there some intangible that makes Miller a better pick than Di Giantonio? Or did Di Giantonio get some intangible that we don't see? You know, is it feedback to their crew? Is it how they work at their setups that's better because they copy a lot of those setups to the other bikes? We're not privy to that information, so I don't really know. In a straight fight, man, to me, they're pretty much equal. I would have a tough time. I could pick either one and say, yeah, this is what I'm going with.
The difference between them, I would say, Jim, is that Miller is scratching around looking for a ride to stay put in MotoGP. I mean, he'd be welcomed in World Superbikes. I mean, there are not that many top rides left available in World Superbikes as things stand. Now, in terms of MotoGP, you have to look at the situation that Ducati find themselves in. You might say through their own stupidity or their own design, whichever point of view you can take, I suppose, is valid if you're willing to argue it. But the facts of the matter are, Bezzecchi's going, Martin's going, and Bastianini's going. So Di Giantonio, who has outperformed Bezzecchi hands down this year, is a kind of an asset that I suspect Ducati are really rather desperate to retain. Now, you can say with reasonable utility that Morbidelli is starting to find a little bit of form, but, you know, they do need to keep hold of Digi. So I suspect that they are doing everything in their power to keep him in the VR46 camp. But Yamaha, if they're opening a checkbook, I would imagine are very tempting. So of the two, and to sort of rebut Gary's point a little bit, I think Digi is actually in demand. He's not being overlooked at this moment in time, now that other cards have kind of settled into place. Yes, Bezzecchi, Martin, Marc Marquez, they were always going to be the prime movers in the market. But now that that's happened, I think Di Giantonio is kind of a little bit of a linchpin in terms of the last few seats anyway.
Very possible. With that done, I suggest we go on to the race weekend.
Yes.
So, again, as stated, it at the Saxon Ring. And we'll start this off with Moto3 as we always do. In the first qualifying session, Esteban, Holgado, Bertelli, and Ogden all got out of that first qualifying session to get into the second qualifying session. With the second qualifying session, we were halfway through and Vira was fast. Alonso was right behind him, followed by Lunetta, which was is the 658 Squadra Corsa bike. Lunetta actually looked like really good. I mean, if you look at how he was riding, it's like they figured something out and it was definitely looking fast. Followed by Fernandez, Rueda, and then Yamanaka. But at the end, when we get down to it at the final bit of qualifying, Vira would take a pole position and he would take it quite handily. He had a few tenths on everybody, even Alonso, who was second. Then Lunetta, Fernandez, Rueda, Munoz is the top six. Then Ogden, Furosawa, Suzuki, Nepa, and Yamanaka. And Ortolo would be 12th. Helgardo had a rough go to be 13th. Piqueras, who was well up, was 14th. And that's where he would start the race from. Now, we get to the race. There were so many penalties that were handed out before the race even started. See if you can follow along with me, Rich.
I'm going to struggle because there's a lot.
I had to write it all down specifically so that I literally could get this right, because half the field was going to take some visit to the long lap penalty lane at the Sachsenring, which is absolutely astronomical. These riders received a long lap penalty, a single long lap penalty. They were Yamanaka, Almanza, Ortola, and Nepa. So they all got one long lap. Then there were double long laps. Double long laps were Burasari, Carrero, Rossi. Lunetta was going to have to, who, you know, qualifies third. It's going to go through there twice. And then Zura Tozawa, it got a double long lap. Then we had grid penalties on top of this. So, okay, hey, here's the people who had grid penalties. Well, Farioli had a grid penalty. Bertelli had a grid penalty. Watley got a grid penalty. And Esteban got a grid penalty. All for irresponsible riding in either practice sessions or qualifying. That's ridiculous.
Five occasions cumulatively meant that they got that penalty, additional penalty. Which does rather beg the question, are the penalties working if people, you know, can get to the point of having done it five times and then they get another penalty? So something's not working.
There's something wrong. The system's broke somehow, Rich, and I honestly don't know how you're gonna fix it. And
well, I distinctly remember, Jim, I can't remember when, because this is obviously a subject that we get into fairly regularly, although not so much with Moto3, and then Sachsenring was just bonkers. But I remember positing an opinion that the only way you're going to solve this is to bench them for a race, and the teams are not allowed to put a substitute rider in. So it's very draconian, it's true, because that affects the teams in terms of sponsors aren't happy if they've not got two bikes out there with, you know, the signage on, etc., etc. But I don't see what else is going to work. The only caveat to this, and I won't go on and on and on, is that it's all very well doing this en masse in Moto3, but why the hell are they not doing this in MotoGP as well? Because some of what we saw going on this weekend was just ridiculous.
Yeah,
but
we'll get there.
We'll park that one for now.
For me, I have two ideas. You either put them on the grid, last row, pointing backwards so they can't see the lights go, because then that makes you look really stupid, right? So do you want the embarrassment of that, or you are going to have to implement stop and go penalties in the pit lane where you're going to have a penalty box? Hey, you now need to report to the penalty box. You must come down at pit speed limit, stop in the box, and we're going to hold you for 30 seconds or whatever we deem necessary, and then you'll be released again.
Yeah. The trouble with that is they're still out on the track. I just think you have to speak to these guys. You're at home for the weekend, and it's just as simple as that.
See, I think this is where I disagree with you to some extent, Rich. And I disagree only in the standpoint that these are kids predominantly. Okay. We're talking 18-year-olds. They're kids. And to deny them track time in a racing situation, I think is harmful for their development. That being said, yeah, these kids have been racing a motorcycle since they were probably four and they should know better, but for some reason they don't. But somehow I can't bring myself to put you as a Moto3 rider, to put you on the bench. Now, I would have no problem doing that to a Moto2 or a MotoGP rider.
But part of the reason why they've raised the minimum age in Moto3 is to get more mature people in there, and it's not working. So they have to go further. And but by the way, at 18, they are adults. Well, certainly in the eyes of the law in the UK, they are.
Well, law in the US, they're adults as well. So, yeah, I see the point. I get that. I understand it. But, yeah, I
think what we can agree upon is that it's patently obvious that the rules and the penalties and so on, as they stand at the moment, and I'm particularly focusing in on dawdling around on the line through practice sessions and particularly qualifying, because it's just downright dangerous. And, you know, Moto3 bikes, I mean, I forget if I have this entirely correct, but I'm sure that the last race in Assen, I'm sure somebody said the qualifying times that they were putting in were quicker than the GP500s used to go around. Now, it's not exactly the same track, but they are not far off. I mean, even at the Sachsenring, the Moto3 bikes were not much more than 10 seconds a lap slower than the, I think, than the Moto GP bike. Certainly the Moto2 bikes are very close now at certain tracks. So the idea that these are little bikes pootling around and are not really that dangerous is just not the case. I mean, they're going very, very fast, and, you know, these closing speeds are massive. And we don't, again, don't need to keep making the point, but when these things collide, you know, a fast bike hitting a slow bike, a deliberately slow bike, this, you know, the outcomes are always bad. So they have to be taught or shown a way to stop doing this. And I think the only way is to get more draconian. I mean, I'm not an advocate for more and more and more and more rules, but the current rules aren't working. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had half of the grid on a penalty, which is just ridiculous.
Agreed. May I remind you, what was it some years ago that, who was it? Zarco was coming out of the pits for the Sachsenring and got clobbered by, I think it was Marquez's bike, right?
It was. That was last year, yeah.
Yeah, and literally it ripped the entire front end off of Zarco's bike. Yeah. So you're correct. These bikes are going fast, and a slow bike does not have anywhere near the force because it's not accelerating as much as what the other bike is. So you're right. There's something, I think we can all agree, there's something very wrong that needs to be fixed. And I don't think you or I or even the stewards really know how to fix it. I think everyone knows it's broke, but we just don't know how, because we've tried points on your license. Well, okay, you did stupid stuff 3 times. Now you can't. You get a race ban.
I think outside of, in terms of talking about this season, outside of David Munoz, you don't see that many race moves. Well, either in qualifying and certainly in the race, you don't see that many moves that you think, oof, that was actually a bit over the limit in terms of danger. I mean, Munoz, I love him to bits. He's, you know, proper racer, but he does skirt that line between acceptable behavior, I think, personally, sometimes. Beyond that, I think a lot of the penalties that get dished out in the races are pointless and needless and actually quite unfair in many cases. The ones that I do take issue with are the people that are just dawdling around on the line, waiting for a tow or for whatever reason. And it's not just Moto3. It happens a bit in Moto2. Saw a bit of it this weekend. I don't know if it's something that's to do with the Sachsenring. And it was terrible in MotoGP this weekend. So those ones, they do need to be penalised. And a lot of the other stuff, I don't think they do at all. But anyway, I mean, that's just my opinion.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the race.
Can I just say, the final irony, Jim, is that the long lap penalty loop at the Sachsenring is terribly dangerous as well. And we nearly saw a really nasty collision in the race. So irony of ironies, you know, you put somebody into the long lap for dangerous riding, and it's one of the more dangerous places to put them.
Yeah.
You couldn't make it up.
Yeah, I know. You can't. Anyway, well, race day. So we start out with Vire getting the whole shot ahead of Lunetta, Munoz, Alonso, Furosato. And when they start the second lap, Vire tosses it away into the gravel trap at the waterfall. I mean, on paper, this was Vire's race to win. He had a great weekend at Assen, got pimped by Artola at the end, right? Maybe with perhaps the wrong tire choice. Don't really know.
Yeah.
And then he comes here had an absolutely blistering qualifying. I think he was 3 or 4 tenths quicker than Alonso. And yet he either lacked the patience to warm up the tire and take just another, just a quick breathe of the throttle and head down the hill, or he was just exuberance of youth and he just said, screw it, I'm pinning it and going through it anyway. Because I think that turn is pretty close to wide open on a Moto3 bike.
I would imagine, yeah.
And he tossed it away and tossed away what I think would have been a sure win. Do you think, if he stays up, ifs and buts, I got it. But do you think he would have beaten everybody else?
I mean, all you can really say is that he's in a very rich vein of form, which of course Alonso is as well.
Yeah.
He was, I'd say, half a foot, maybe a foot offline going through there. And I think that's why it tucked, because I had a lot of rain overnight on Saturday. Took a lot of the rubber off the track, so it didn't take much to go down. And I think I'm right in saying, Jim, throughout the whole of the Sunday, he was the only rider to go down in that corner.
Yes.
On the Sunday, yes. My memory serves me correctly. So it was a bit unfortunate, but he was offline. Now, why he was offline, obviously, I don't know. I mean, gust of wind, just first lap, drifted a little bit with a cooler tire. Who knows? It was a heavy penalty for a very minor infraction. I mean, I think we can say that. Would he have been on the top step of the podium? Who knows? But he would definitely have been top six. I mean, I don't think there's any question about that, because he was very, very fast all weekend. It was just a great shame, really, because not so much for the race, because the race was good. But, it's the points table is really becoming troublesome now, because it's hard to see who can catch up to Alonso now. So it was a big kind of, I don't want to say an own goal for people are now referring to him as Colin Vaya. I've been calling him Colin Vaya. I think perhaps the pronunciation is Vaya, but so apologies to any of the Dutch listeners if we got that wrong. But yeah, just a shame really, because it's going to take the wind out of his sails a little bit. Although, having said all of that, I still think he's going to win quite a few races throughout the rest of the season between him and Alonso. I don't really see anybody else getting much of a look in as things stand at the minute.
That's true. With Vaya, which way was it said, Rich?
Vaya, I think, is what people have started Vaya to refer to him as. Yeah,
I kind of noticed that too. I never did write down my pronunciation there to correct myself, but I'll have to make a note to not say it the other way. But that left Munoz out front, because Munoz got his elbows out and basically, any small gap Munoz is through, so now he's out front. Alonso hanging out there sort of in the second pace. And then, Furisato looking great on the Honda. And they're all right there together, followed by Luneta, Rueda, and Fernandez. Finally, Alonso goes to the front and, he just places Munoz on there or whatever. But that's all well and good. But then Ortolo is almost tagged by Nepa when they come through the long lap penalty, right? Or I got this wrong, because I've got...
Was it Yamanaka?
Yamanaka. Yeah. I got it now. So
Yamanaka was going through the long lap, yeah. I think, and Ortolo was
right
kind of
there,
just
and they all like bumped into each other, and you're like, okay, who's almost going to go off here? Which was absolutely crazy. Then you had Munoz, who went right back to the front again, and over Munoz or whatever. But Munoz then almost high sides himself, and then that caused Rolstein to be banged into, and then he winds up going through the gravel. So that was an interesting one there too, because that was more craziness that's going on. Vaqueros had a big moment along the way. Seemed like all the Moto3 guys were sort of like in or out of the seat, and they're always, it's tight and twisty, so everybody's banging into each other. Lines are converging back on top of each other. It's a crazy race. But with 15 to go, Alonso goes to the front, and he's followed by Fernandez and Rueda and Furisato, and they've got a gap of about 3 tenths over Munoz and Horgado. But then that all just goes right back together again after about a lap, and we got a lead group of 12 again. Now, Rolstein and Piqueras come together, and Rolstein almost, I mean, it was bucking Bronco time for Rolstein. And he rode that one off into the gravel trap and saved it, which was absolutely amazing that he was actually able to do that, which was really crazy. Again, Alonso is now out front, been out front. He's staying out front, but everybody else is moving around behind him, right? Burisato is second. Rueda is now third. Then it's Adrian Fernandez, then Munoz, then Piqueras, right? Then Rolstein was down at 11. So I think he was the only other one to crash at the waterfall. But I don't know if the bike was damaged in the crash or the almost crash or whatever, because you get to those moments where it was later. But I don't know. I mean, I don't think anything happened to it because he wouldn't have kept going unless he did. But he did go down there. Alonso is still leading, but Rueda got by Furosato, who was wide at one. It's like he misjudged the braking just by a couple of millimeters, opened up the door, and voila, Rueda goes by. But then Furosato got by Alonso at seven, which was a great move. That's a place that nobody really, like, people will pass at one, they'll pass at eight, they'll pass at 12 and 13, but nobody ever really goes through at seven. And that was a great move to go by. Furosato was just like taking, and I think he did it around the outs. No, he was going around the outside of everybody at like 13, but it was like, wow, that was just crazy riding by Furosato. I mean, Furosato really takes really different lines than anybody else. And he's very creative about figuring out a way to pass where nobody else is passing. He invents passing lanes that people don't think about. He's interesting to do, especially because now it seems like at this track, the Honda did not seem to be as much of a disadvantage as it has been. I don't think it's because Honda's brought any parts or pieces for the bikes. I think a lot of people have changed some of their setup on the bikes. I know that's what 658 said. That's why Lunetta was so good. It was because they had changed the setup. They went back to something that made them more comfortable. Well, okay, if you're comfortable, you're going to go faster. That's for sure. But also, the idea of the twisty nature of the track sort of kind of takes away from KTM's acceleration advantage that they have. So this was becoming like a really fascinating race as we go. We've got a 7-rider lead group now with about 5 laps to go. And Alonso's still out front. Rueda, now Ortolo has now caught up, because remember, Ortolo had a single long lap, if I remember correctly. Yes, Ortolo had a single long lap. And also, Ortolo had worked his way up. Again, you really don't know where to watch things because there's so many people. Other than Alonso being sort of the permanent front leader, everybody else is interchangeable. Take your pick. It's a great race because there's so much going on that you're not really seeing all of what's going on. But with 3 laps to go, it's Alonso followed by Rueda, Ortolo, Furosato, Piqueras, Fernandez, and Holgado. Then Furosato, it looks like maybe the front's going away because he had a soft and he starts to drift back. Like there wasn't enough grip in that Pirelli. So he starts to fall off. Then Rueda crashes at turn one. It's like, it was a very odd crash because the back end was locked up going in there. And I'm wondering if it was a gearbox issue something in the gearbox jammed or broke, because it seemed like it was out of control when he was on the front brake even harder. And then he was like, doing a stoppie into the corner, but there was already this long black line that had been there. Now, generally, and it depends on who the riders are, you don't really have a whole lot of rear brake on the motorcycle. It's not like real super touchy. One, because it's through your foot and your boot, which you don't really have the feel, right? So you try to set it up to be, and I'll use this as a go-in mushy rear brake, if you will. Now, I'm not saying that he couldn't still have locked it up with the rear brake, but just judging by his body position, it just seemed really weird. And it happened going well into the corner. Like, this black mark is well before you would think you would have something happen. It was just an odd crash. And I don't know if there was actually anything wrong with the bike or if it was just a mistake, but I was very suspect of it being a gearbox, which is possible.
It did look mechanical, didn't it? It's like the old two-stroke days when you get a seizure almost. But I don't know. They go over that bump into the braking error, and I suppose you don't have to be far off your braking marker in terms of getting it wrong, and suddenly everything's going wrong very, very quickly. So because he was going to T-bone. I forget who was directly in front of him at that point, but he was going to hit somebody. So he kind of panics, as you would do. It was a big crash, though, Jim.
It was.
Now, that air fence is not far away in turn one. And even on a Moto3 bike, you know, they do get there pretty quickly if the circumstances conspire in that way. So I haven't read anything as to what caused the crash. So I don't know, unless anybody else has. I'd be interested to know. But yeah, it was an odd one anyway.
It was very odd. But with the last few laps that were going on and the craziness that was ensuing, Alonso would take the win. Furosato would get past Ortola to take second. Furosato would be second. Ortola was third. Then Adrian Fernandez, then Piqueras, Yamanaka, Holgado, Munoz, Suzuki, Ogden, Kelso, Nepa, Feroli, Esteban, and Bertelli take the top 15 in all the points. That was a crazy Moto3 race. It was a fantastic Moto3 race, really, to be honest with you. It was one of those ones that was like, yeah, that's a pretty darn good race going on right there for the whole thing. And, although Alonso did lead a whole lot of that race, there was still so much other stuff going on around him that made that race interesting for sure. Best race of the weekend, no, hands down.
Ooh. Oh, really? I was going to say, going to say the Moto2 race was the best race. But yeah, I mean, it was a very, very good Moto3 race.
I like this one the best.
No question about it. Furosato, I mean, we've seen him pop up in sort of dribs and drabs in the last season or two. I can't remember the season that he first entered Moto3, but he's really showing it this year, isn't he? And as you say, Jim, he was certainly able to conjure up some lines that were very different to what other people were doing. He had a proper go at it on the last lap and almost took himself off the bike. So he kind of didn't get to challenge Alonso in the end. Just another, solid ride from David Alonso. And that's underplaying it, really, isn't it? So you're going to go through the points in a minute, I'm sure, Jim. But, you know, there's the strange conundrum of Danny Holgado. It's kind of in the pack, but just never really looked like he was going to trouble the very, very front. I'll just give a little shout out to Scott Ogden, who's pedaling a fairly old Honda around and doing a solid job as often as he can. Colin Vire did get back on the bike amazingly, given how big that crash was, and did finish 19th. Okay, he didn't spoil any points, but under the circumstances, to get back on and hammer around for the whole race on a bike that must have been quite damaged. Never mind the disappointment he must have felt to finish 19th was a very sort of creditable outcome, I think. Yeah, a good race, interesting race, but Alonso did always look as if he was going to win it. Ortola, you kind of thought perhaps, was he going to do what he sometimes does, and often does, in fact, and come through? But just, yeah, for whatever reason, I don't know if he burnt his tire or what, but yeah, Alonso just looks pretty well unbeatable, doesn't he, most places he goes now?
Yeah, he is the wunderkin of the group, if as we would like to say.
Wunderbar, yeah.
Yeah. So Alonso leads the championship on 179 points. That puts him 58 clear of Ortola. He's 59 ahead of Holgado, because Ortola, with that strong third place, jumped up there. Vayer was down because he's now fourth in points on 115, 64 now behind Alonso. Then it's Munoz, Yamanaka, Fernandez, Piqueras, Rueda, Kelso, rounding out your top 10 in Moto3. It is not David Alonso's championship yet, although a 2-race lead in points at this point going into the summer break. And he is on a run of form that seems to be almost unstoppable. I mean, he did have an off day in the Netherlands, but that's a tricky circuit, I think, to really understand and come around on. I was trying to think if last year if he had difficulties at it or not. To be honest, I don't really remember. But either way, Alonso looks supreme. And it's his championship to lose, but we're not going to hand it to him yet.
No. I mean, before people start shouting Jerez very loudly at their speakers, I know he crashed at Jerez on lap one out of the lead. But other than that, I mean, he just never looks as if he's under pressure. That's the scary thing about him, even when he's out front. And again, was it in Q1, was it, that he went through? I mean, he has this ability to just withhold the pressure and put in a lap when he has to. That's why he's so good on the last lap of a race. Okay, he didn't need to pull in for that, particularly on this occasion, but he's unflappable. That's the scary thing about him, and that's what makes him such a great prospect. He has a lot in reserve, and all the best ones have a lot of reserve capacity for when they need to bring it out. So that's, yeah, there's still a long way to go, but 58 points in the lead. Yeah, he can protect that easily, but he won't. I mean, he'll just go out and keep winning races.
Don't change what works.
Exactly.
Alonso's last lap was a lot better than some other people's last lap. That's for sure.
Yep.
So, true. Yeah. Hey, some people hold up to pressure and some don't. Anyway. Oh, that's our Moto 3.
Jim, just one piece of news that I spotted this evening on Instagram. Probably won't come as any enormous shock to many people, but I spotted that Josh Whatley and the Vision Track squad have parted company with immediate effect. Where he's going to end up, he says there's news coming, don't know, but that association has run its course anyway. So it's just, you know, it's a shame, but perhaps not totally unexpected, because Josh has toiled away mostly at the rear of the field since he came in on that team. Now, that's not to say he won't go to another team, different bike, and do much better. So, you know, hopefully that'll be the case. But spotted that on the socials tonight.
Oh, okay. Well, let's go to Moto 2 and see what's happening here. Roberts was back with a plated collarbone. If you follow his Instagram, I think he had 7 screws in his collarbone to hold the plate. The x-ray was pretty gnarly looking. I'll give it that one. But anyway, we were in all credit to Joe. He made it directly to the Q2, which, okay, that's pretty impressive. But in the first qualifying session, it was Vietti, Foggia, Binder, Aegis all went through to the second session. Halfway through the second session, Arbolino was the quickest, followed by Agura, Moreira, Gonzalez, Lopez, Ramirez, Audiger, and Roberts. Garcia was like 14th, which was definitely not Garcia's best qualifying effort. In fact, Garcia would then go down at turn one as well in qualifying, which left us with the finals tally as the checker flag fell, of Vietti being on pole position, followed by Jake Dixon. Way to go, Britain. And that's why you're so special. I think this race is so special, Rich, is because of Jake. Jake had a great weekend. He did, honestly.
He did. No, to be fair, he did.
Second place was a good place for him to be. Audiger was third, then Aegis. So you had Vietti and Aegis, who came out of the first qualifying session, going to the top. Now, I hate to go down this path of tires, but when we were in the Dunlop era of Moto 2, how many guys came out of the first session and went fast enough to be on pole or be at in the first couple of rows? This didn't happen. There was the oddity. Okay, somebody's yelling that, hey, so-and-so did it in this one. Yes, I got it. But what I'm trying to say is it's been far more common that people coming out of two with the Pirelli tires seem to be able to do as good or better themselves a little bit than they would if they were on the Dunlops for whatever reason. And basically they're still qualifying in essentially the heat of the day that they always were running in. And so, which is pretty amazing. And then we found out that like Pirelli had brought a new compound and construction to, they say, well, let's see if I got this right. Like the SC0, I think, is the softest tire that they bring for the Moto 2 bikes. Well, they had like an SC.5, which really wasn't an SC1. It was a little bit harder than the 0, but it wasn't as hard as like an SC1. So I'm going to call it a 0.5, if you will. But the thing is here is that Pirelli brought this tire to us. And I'm just thinking back, like in MotoGP, when Michelin said, well, we got a front tire, we want to test it, we want to bring, oh, we can't do this, we can't change it. Or like, you know, I think it maybe that happened in the Bridgestone era too. Bridgestone had some tire they wanted to bring in and they're like, oh, no, no, we can't do that in the middle of the championship. This is going to be a disaster. Oh, nobody's going to know what to do with it. It's like, nobody seemed to care. I mean, Dixon actually chose that tire to race on in there, which, I mean, I hate to say this, but props to Pirelli, really. Honestly, the Moto3 bikes have been faster because of the tires, right? Moto2 has been faster, basically because of the Pirellis. And there's not been a person that's complaining that those tires are junk. Now, some people have had a harder time adapting to them. That's for sure. I give you Arbolino.
Yep.
Right. So, I mean, you know, that was, you know, one of those things. But
my theory, Jim, on this, to pick up on your point, and we have talked about this before, and I think it's reflected in the fact of what you've just said about, you know, Vietti goes through Q1 and then sticks it on pole. I think the Pirellis, well, we know they're about feel, whereas I think with the Dunlop era, it was about setup, and it tended to favour the people that were always at the top of the, you know, the top teams, whereas now it feels as if people that wouldn't have got a look in before, because they've got feel and they just had that experience on the tyre in the previous session, they just translate that immediately. So, yeah, for me, it's feel versus setup is the difference between the Pirelli and the Dunlop era in Moto2. Don't know what you think, but
I think you're right. There's definitely a feel part of it. I mean, it's always feel, and that's what it is.
I think you can ride around an imperfect setup on the Pirelli in Moto2 in a way that you would never have been able to have done in the Dunlop era, because they were such more rigid, hard, unforgiving tyres. Didn't really give you much. So if you didn't have setup, you were done. The only person that really has suffered, and interesting that this was the weekend when we appeared to see immediate progress, is Arbolino, as you just said.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason, he's taken some time to get his head around. Well, I'm assuming it's a Pirelli thing. I mean, I don't know that. But let's assume that that is the case. But he certainly had a much, much better weekend this weekend. And let's hope that that's a trajectory that we see him continue on.
Well, they said that Mark Villa said that they went back to an earlier setup. And that seems to be working. So apparently they were chasing it. And they just finally, as all good teams at some point do, you say, well, okay, we're going to go back to what we started with. And forget this moving everything around. Let's go back here and work our way back out of the hole.
I mean, who knows? Maybe he was trying to create a bike that felt more like the Moto2 bike on the Dunlops.
Which you're not going to do.
No, and so they've just gone back to absolute beginnings and said, right, let's go from here. And yeah, maybe that's the way to do it. I don't know. I mean, I'm not a bike racer and I'm certainly not a technician setting up bikes, but everybody else seems to be enjoying the Pirellis, and at long last, Arbolino looked as if he was. So, which is good news for the championship, because we want to see Tony Arbolino at the front.
Right. So I think we had Dixon second, and then I deviated and went on a tangent. But Audiger was third. So again, Audiger showing some continued pace as well. Then Aegis, who, you know, again, came out of that first session. Then Gonzalez, Arbolino. Iagura was seventh. Marrero was eighth. Ninth was Ramirez. Then Lopez. Roberts qualified 11th. So I missed my qualifying. I said Roberts would qualify in that 5-6-7 area. He did not. He qualified 11th, which still that wasn't bad given where he was going to be, considering he had qualified ahead of just one place, though. But he did qualify one place ahead of Garcia, who was in the gravel trap as well. So, you know, hey, all fair play. The guy that you're chasing the championship, if you're starting ahead of him, that gives you some form of advantage over it. So we would go into the race the next day. Again, we talked about all of the rain that had come or whatever, but Dixon got the whole shot up ahead of Vietti, followed by Audiger, Aegis, and Arbolino. Roberts would start out in 13th. Vietti was then by Dixon and into the lead. Then Arbolino had moved his way up to second. So Arbolino came sort of charging through the pack at the very beginning to get up to second. And Audiger went to the lead, and because he got by Vietti, who then dropped all the way to third because everybody else, you know, the area was opened. So Vietti went back to third because Audiger went by, Arbolino went by, then Vietti there, right? Because the door had been opened. Then Aegis is there, Dixon, Gonzalez. Roberts had moved himself to 10th. Then Arboleda was by Audiger. So that was pretty promising. Like, oh, hey, we're going to see some racing, because I did fear that Audiger was going to sort of run off and, you know, basically not get going again, or, you know, lead and be gone. And we were going to see that form that Audiger had at the end of last year, just winning race after race after race and just basically pure dominance. But with Audiger, or with Arboleda, sorry, getting back by Audiger, that looked promising. Garcia was up to sixth now. Roberts was 13th and had fallen back again. So Joe was having an up and down moment. But then Audiger went right back to the front again. With 15 to go, it was Audiger, Arboleda, Vietti, Dixon, Aegis, Garcia, and Agüero. Audiger still out front and heading on and going well. Then Arboleda was then down to fifth from second. It looked like the rear grip was going on the bike, because he would just try to get on the gas, and the bike just didn't go forward. There was no momentum forward. It just took a lot for him to actually get going or whatever. Now, somewhere along the way, Audiger got a track limits warning. And I think he got it fairly early on in the race. So I think he had like 18 laps or more that he had to do with that. Audiger had gotten to like a 1.7 second lead, and he was really just basically gone. Garcia had gotten to seventh. Roberts was 11th, which he picked himself up, which was pretty good. Then at some point, and I don't have this in my notes, Rich, maybe you've got it, but Audiger had to go to the long lap penalty loop. Didn't he? Because he had the limit. And I swear he got penalty lap, because that is how.
No, I don't think so. I don't remember Audiger going through the long lap. No.
I thought he did. Maybe it was just that everybody was talking about the fact that if he did, that he had track limits problems, but I guess that's not necessarily the truth.
I'm hurriedly looking through my notes and making sure I don't have this wrong in my head, but
I thought he did. I thought he had to go through it, but I could be wrong. Again, that's my bad. That's my bad, folks. If I got that one.
No, I'm pretty sure not, Jim.
Okay.
Pretty
so he sure did. Not. Okay. Well, I don't have it in my notes either. They took the long lap. But I swear that's how the lead changed, but that's not necessarily the case. With five laps to go, Audiger's leading, then followed by Dixon, by Vietti, Agüero, Aegis, and Garcia. Now, Aegis has a rear grip problem. He's going backwards. Roberts was up to ninth with three to go. Two to go, it's Audiger, Dixon, Vietti, Agüero, Moreira, Garcia. Ninth is Roberts. Then at the end, Audiger goes on to win the race. Dixon will finish second. Then Agüero makes his way up to third, followed by Moreira, Vietti, who worked his way backwards. Then Chantra had snuck into sixth. Garcia would be seventh. Roberts would finish eighth, and Arboleda would fall back to ninth. Then Lopez, Aegis, Gonzalez, Guevara, and Alcoba, and Massia getting the last point. That was pretty impressive by Audiger to hang on that long and not get the long lap penalty, which I thought he did, but shows you what I know or remember, or how poorly I take notes for the show.
You're misremembering Assen, where you got the long lap there.
I think that maybe I got maybe inside of that, but it was good to see Audiger actually win a race and, you know, hold up to that. Great for Dixon to be second after the hideous start to the season that Jake had, for him to come back. Agüero looking strong with another third place finish. And you got to sort of wonder where Garcia is in all this. He's had a couple of bad races in a row, and he's definitely not on the form that he was on earlier this in the season, which makes me wonder, is there some truth to the fact that, you know, Yamaha/Pramac are looking at Garcia to go on to one of those Yamahas? Because is his eye taking off the prize of Moto2 because he's dealing with these negotiations, or he's in the hunt to get that seat? I mean, everybody's going to want to ride a MotoGP bike. So is that it? I mean, you know, to me, it's like, well, I don't know where his form has gone. As Arbolino's form has kind of went up, at least for the beginning, and then fall down. Garcia was just nowhere this weekend, basically. I mean, he kind of was right where he qualified.
It's a tricky one to judge. I mean, the thing about Garcia is he's pretty consistent, so he takes the finishes when he can't win. And let's be honest, I mean, that empty helmets Bosque Escura squad have completely outshone the main Bosque Escura squad so far this year. Okay, Aldegu won the race, but that's the first time that they've really been superior to the empty helmets squad. So, and the Kalixes were much stronger in Germany as well. So that kind of muddies the picture a little bit, I think, Jim. So I think Garcia is kind of doing solid work. Having said all of that, he does need to start to trouble the podium again if he wants to maintain this title push. And you're entirely right. I mean, if there is genuine MotoGP contract discussions going on, that is bound to kind of affect his performance a little bit. I think he's only human. I mean, it would affect anybody's performance a bit, I think. The interesting one for me in all of this, we've spoken about Arbolino. The other interesting one, I think, is Dixon, because he has had a very troubled start to the year. Now, we know he had that enormous crash right at the very beginning in Qatar, and that did set him back in terms of injury. And he may even well still be kind of recovering to some extent from that, because he damaged his lung and all sorts. So it was a big hit that he took. But I needed to remind myself that he's also kind of become like a de facto WP suspension test mule in the first half of the season as well. And I think they're only just starting to find the setting on that bike. And it's interesting that here and in Assen, he's performed very, very strongly. So, provided he can steer clear of Darren Binder, it'll be interesting to see how he gets on in Silverstone, bearing in mind what happened last year. Because you can start to see the health and the fitness, as well as the bike setup, starting to come back to Jake Dixon. And that bodes well, I hope, from a British perspective, you know, for the Silverstone round in, 2.5 weeks' time. So, yeah, might have been a little bit tough on Jake, because I think the suspension thing might have been completely clouded the picture, because I don't know who else runs WP, if anybody else runs it outside of that Aspar squad. I would need to double check on that, and again, if people can know and let us know, by all means do so. But I think he's been chasing setup for some of the season, as well as overcoming the injuries that he sustained in Qatar. So interesting to see what the second half of the season looks like once they come back from the summer break.
Agreed. Now, Audiger's win wasn't without a bit of drama. After the end of the race and before the start of the MotoGP race, if you were watching the whole live feed, they did flash up that Audiger's tire pressure was under investigation. Okay, well, time out here. Apparently, there was nothing else said about it during the broadcast. I found no other notations anywhere that I could find. So the result stands as Audiger winning, which leaves us with a very interesting championship. And this one might be the best championship going. Well, it is the best championship going right now, I think. Garcia is on 147 points, but he's only 7 ahead of Ayagura. So the two MTI Helmets teammates are 1-2. Roberts is only 24 points off of Garcia, meaning he only lost 1 point to Garcia, which is phenomenal considering now he's got, 3 weeks-ish to get the collarbone there. My wife will tell you that a broken bone is healed in about 4 and completely mended in 6. So yep. Joe should be pretty good come Silverstone, right?
Silverstone, yeah. Yeah, no, it was a great, great weekend for Joe Roberts. I mean, he must have gritted his teeth, because that would have been painful, I'm sure.
And he did finish where I thought he would finish.
He did superb. He did everything he had to do.
He did well. I was really
and
impressed.
Interestingly, I see a headline from David Brivio at Trackhouse saying that Roberts is back in the conversation, or was to that effect, in terms of next year. So Joe will be continuing to turn heads, I think, with his performances this year, and fair play to him.
Yeah, I completely agree. Audiger's win vaults him to 4th. Then it's Lopez, Gonzalez, Canet, Kinnett had a terrible weekend.
Terrible.
I mean, I was he was like non-existent. Like was Kinnett even there? Did anybody even mention him? It's just, it's weird how he can be so up, so down. It's just funny. Chantra is eighth. Vietti is ninth. And Dixon with that podium and second place finish is 10th in the points. So it's a, I look at it, I don't know about you, I think it's a four rider race for the championship between Garcia, Agüero, Roberts, and Audiger. I think the gap is too big for Lopez to be a player in that one. But I mean, wow. I mean, it's going to be interesting. As you said, quite rightly, if Garcia wants this championship, he's going to have to start getting onto the podium. If Roberts wants this championship, he needs to start winning races. If Audiger wants his championship, he has to start winning races. If Agüero wants
lots of races,
he needs a lottery. Audiger needs a lottery. He needs to put a run of like four or five, six wins in a row on, right? And Agüero needs to continuously finish top two, top three. He can't afford to not be on the podium, right? I mean, it's really tight. And it's tight for a lot of riders, you know. So like I said, this I think is the best championship going. Although I did think the race was somewhat lackluster because I obviously tried to inject the fact that there was a long lap penalty that didn't exist for Audiger.
Well, that's interesting perspective. I mean, I on my notes I wrote this is as kind of good as a Moto3 race because there was a lot of action. I know once Audiger got out front, he did kind of boss it, you know, second and a half in the lead, but there was a lot of racing going on from second downwards. And I just wrote in my notes, the unbridled joy of good Moto2 racing at long last, because we've really missed Moto2 almost since its inception, really. And I think without wishing to be unkind towards Dunlop, I think we could put a lot of that at their feet, boots, whatever you want to call it. You know, because with Pirelli's on these bikes, they've come alive, haven't they? And so has the championship. The only black spot on the whole weekend from race direction was watching Audiger go over the line to take the win on his own, whilst there was a battle going on with Aguirre for the podium. Now, they did put it, they have started to put a little kind of thumbnail in screenshot, which is good at long last, because we've been asking for this for a long, long time. But really, they should have had Audiger in the little thumbnail, really, because there was nothing to see there, whereas behind, you know, it was all kicking off. But anyway, other than that, I'm just picking hairs, really. But
yeah, I think we are in that.
Yeah, I think I thought the Moto2 race was the best race of the weekend for me.
But okay,
subjective.
You're allowed. I thought Moto3 was the best one. So
Moto3 was a great race too. I mean, when is Moto3 not a great race?
Yeah, those guys are absolutely. We'll figure out anywhere that they possibly can pass. They'll pass. So let's move on to the grand finale here, the MotoGP qualifying in Q1. You had Miller, Marquez, that is Mark, Quartararo, Bezzecchi, and Raul. On the second run, there was many people that were dawdling on their outlaps. Miller went into the gravel at turn one as others around him were in the way. He barely missed a couple people going into the gravel trap. People were just dawdling there. Miller seemed to have not necessarily misjudged it, but misjudged how slow everybody was going towards the racing line, which was kind of crazy. But then we had sort of, because as Miller went by, he almost took out Marc Marquez in this attack. And he almost got Raul and Bezzecchi because they all sort of like were all there dawdling around. And here comes Miller and, you know, whatever happened there. Not really sure. I don't know if it was just Jack's fault or if it was people dawdling that caused him to suddenly decide that I need to, you know, check up here. But it was like the beginning of what was a very scary problem, because when we got into second runs, Brattle at turn, I think it's three. It's the Omega part of the track.
Yeah.
Brattle's on the inside. Marquez is going for a timed hot lap to get himself into Q1. And Brattle abruptly turns hard 90 degrees right and goes across the line with Marquez on a hot lap, which then you saw the huge black mark that Marquez had out under the bike. I'm not sure if it was rear brake, if he was spinning it up to try to split the corner. But basically, Brattle pulls off the most boneheaded move of the entire weekend of anybody dawdling. That was the biggest boneheaded move. I agree with Simon Patterson. If you saw his tweet on X about it, should have been race ban for Brattle. I wholeheartedly can't disagree with that one. It was scary because all I had was the flashbacks of Marquez's bike going into Zarco's bike out of the pit lane a year ago, right, and destroying it. So it was like, oh, good grief, right? And, you know, to Brattle's credit, he did hunt down Marquez on the track. He apologized right then. I'm pretty sure Brattle probably walked into the Gersini pits and explained himself, to which it doesn't matter. He ruined Mark's qualifying. I mean, legitimately really screwed up his qualifying session. And, you know, and then to go down this rant of penalties, Brattle receives a grid place penalty. Brattle was basically last anyways. The penalty's pointless. Mm. I am not picking on Brattle here, people. He did something stupid, but I'm not trying to throw him under the bus for his stupidity. I'm talking about the stupidity of the penalties. It's like, what else could you do other than give him a race ban, right? But are they going to do that because Honda needs the development time? I don't know. That's a conspiracy theory of mine, right? Like, despite the fact that he probably needed a race ban and be set down, like, look, you shouldn't really do that in a good talking to, he still got the lineup and race with a 3-grid penalty. Oy. You got anything to say about penalties, Rich? I know you probably do.
Well, I mean, I saw the tweets that Simon P put out, and, you know, I actually responded on one of them to say that I think probably it was worthy of a race ban. I mean, I don't know. We've just kind of landed in this awkward spot now. I mean, clearly they can't all be out in a qualifying session on every lap doing qualifying time. So, I mean, it's hard not to get in the way from time to time. I do understand that. However, Bridle's very experienced, and to sort of go across the track in the way that he did, I'm sure he's embarrassed about it. I mean, he's a charming guy whenever you see him interviewed, and he's been around a long, long time, very, very experienced. So there's no malice in it, you know, but it's just indicative of this kind of black hole of people are afraid to sort of be on the line, get off the line. You know, there's just penalties flying around everywhere. But then, like you say, Jim, to give a guy a 3-place grid drop when he's already 21st out of 22 is, well, what sort of a penalty is that? It's just all a bit of a joke, really, when it gets to this sort of thing. So, and let's not forget, of course, on Friday, Marc Marquez had the mother and father of Highsides going through the waterfall section.
Yes,
so
he did.
The last thing he needed was a collision, which, you know, could easily have happened in that situation. So he had very, very badly bruised ribs, which must have been agonizing to, you know, to ride on, as well as a damaged hand, I think it was. So
yeah, left index finger was broken. So the clutch was now his middle finger, his ring finger, and his pinky. And I don't know if you caught this, but now the gloves, well, at least by Alpenstart, I'm assuming from everybody else, they're sewing the ring finger and the pinky finger together. So the pinky finger is now supported by the ring finger, because that's always, you know, the one that's there. So I thought that was a kind of cool idea, because Simon Crafar was talking about that when they were showing Mark, you know, holding his index finger up and working the clutch. Like, you can see that the glove is now, you know, they're being sewn with the to give some support to the pinky, which is, you know, kind of interesting how that all goes along, and the little things that mean a lot. Because, I mean, that's your pinky that flops around out there, the one that always seems to get broke. But if you got it supported to the other part of your hand, it's a really cool idea. So that was, you know, I'm sure that he's probably had that for a year or so, but we've just now maybe picked up on this fact. It wasn't not something that they just did overnight to sew it together. So it'd be interesting to see if any of the other guys have that as well. Or at least Simon led me to believe that it was something that had been around for a little bit and they just never had talked about.
Coming back to Brattle, I mean, he was just kind of like the worst case of something that we saw throughout the weekend, really. And I mean, I would never normally in this day and age be somebody to kind of credit Formula One with anything, really, other than boring everybody to tears most of the time. But they do have this kind of minimum lap time, or vector time, I think they call it, a minimum required speed to be getting around the course. And okay, I accept in Formula One they have pits to car rage over. That's kind of the worst thing ever. Because it's just like a school playground moaning channel most of the time. But it does at least give the pits the ability to say to the driver, you've got somebody coming up behind you, get out of the way. So, okay, we don't have that. And thankfully, we don't have pits to rider communications at the moment. Although maybe we're getting to the stage where we kind of need it. I don't know, because clearly they need to be getting out of the way of somebody on a quick lap. But equally, you can't be dawdling around and then shooting across the track like that. And we've seen a lot of this. And, you know, it's like this whole thing about outcomes get punished, intent doesn't, you know, and is it going to take a massive collision? A bit like the one we saw last year, which was a different scenario because that was somebody coming out of pits and a bike crashing. But it goes to show what happens when a fast-moving bike and a slow-moving bike come into contact with each other. So, you know, this is going to happen at some point. And then, of course, there'll be like a draconian bricks falling out of the sky kind of response to it. And I'm sure they could do something better. I mean, you see people on social media saying, oh, we need to go to one lap qualifying where everybody takes their turn. Well, we don't want that. And there's no room in the schedule to accommodate a system like that anyway. So we definitely don't want that. They just need to start penalising the MotoGP guys and stop treating them like prima donnas, because, you know, if they do stuff wrong, they should just get into trouble for it, you know, and proper trouble as well, you know, decent penalties that really do impact them.
So thinking about kind of what you said about pit radios and cars in Formula One and sector times, I'm wondering if it wouldn't be easier to put a light on the dash of the MotoGP bike that's a blinking yellow or some other color to alert you that if somebody is faster coming hard on a qualifying lap, to alert you to get over and, you know, be mindful of this guy that's coming, which might be the best, might be a viable solution to what's going on. I mean, we learned that Aprilia had put a blue light in the dash for Vinales, which would tell him if the light was on, meant the front tire, the right hand side of the tire was cold. It wasn't, so you got to give it another lap to get temperature. And when the light goes off, now you can push it through the waterfall. Well, I thought that's a brilliant piece of kit. That right there is you know, a props to Aprilia. So I'm thinking, why can't you do sort of the same thing to warn guys that, hey, somebody fast is coming? Or you could use it in this way. Say, look, hey, we've determined that you have to go through these sectors at a certain time to be adequately fast. And if the light starts blinking, you're in trouble of not making that sector time and you need to speed up. So it can be used either way. I'm not sure which way is the best way. I'm just spitballing here.
When it comes to electronics and dashboards, I mean, they can pretty much do anything that they want with the technology that exists now. You know, the argument would be, do the riders need more inputs because they're already dealing with a lot? However, I would counter that by saying in a couple of years' time, they're not going to be pressing buttons left, right, and centre to lower ride height devices and stuff like that. So they're going to get some capacity back. So I think, you know, there is an opportunity to introduce some other safety mechanisms that might perhaps alleviate this problem to some degree. I'm really interested if anybody's got strong feelings on this to write in and let us know by email, because maybe we're whinging and moaning about it and other people think we're just, you know, we're overdoing it. And maybe we are, but I don't know. I mean, you can see a collision coming before long if they let this drift any further.
Yep. If you guys got any ideas on how to solve the dawdling around the track as well, let us know. Motopod@motopodcast.com. With that, we know that Raul and Bezzecchi got through to the second qualifying session, which meant that both Trackhouse bikes were in the second qualifying session. Bravo, Trackhouse, right?
Yeah.
So with the first runs done, Martin was on pole, followed by Raul Fernandez. Whoa, wasn't expecting that one, right? With Alex Marquez next, then Benyaya, then Morbidelli, then Vinales. But Vinales then went down at turn 10 with a massive high side. That was a scary one. Barriers involved again as well. Like, that's not good. Then Alex Marquez crashed. Benyaya cannot get himself going because he's basically being compromised by the yellow flags that are out for everything. So that left Jorge Martin on pole, Miguel Oliveira and Trackhouse second. Raul Fernandez, Trackhouse third. Trackhouse on the front row. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, well, particularly in relation to the works pipes, which were
nowhere to be found. Which we should mention that Aleix sat this out because of his injuries from Assen. He didn't feel like riding, didn't want to ride, or he's just getting used to how he's going to feel riding a Honda. Ooh, did I say that out loud?
Ooh, Jim, ouch.
That was brutal. Anyway, sorry.
And let's not forget, Savadori was quite badly injured at Assen as well, so he couldn't come in and substitute because I think he cracked a couple of vertebrae in his spine in a crash at Assen. That one went slightly under the radar because, he's a test rider wildcarding, so he's not really out there racing per se. But, yeah, he wasn't around to sub. So lucky for Aprilia that, for whatever reason, Trackhouse. And, I mean, delighted, really, actually, to see Miguel Oliveira, who's really been in the doldrums. But he came out of the gates right from the get-go on Friday, and he was brilliant all weekend.
Yeah, I think I read somewhere that Quartararo said that, because Oliveira is in the running for that Pramac Yamaha seat, that Quartararo said, he'd be great. He's my best mate in the pit, and then he'd be great on the bike. He'd be a great development guy. Yada, yada. A lot, for Oliveira to show up and whatnot. And what Fernandez is getting a 24 Aprilia now, because Oliveira has a 24, but next week or after the 3 week break, he'll have a 24 bike.
Yeah. I mean, if you were being very, very cynical with all the talk around Pramac Yamaha, you might say that suddenly Miguel Oliveira's interest is up. But I think that would be uncharitable because he's a proper professional, Miguel, but he is a bit hot and cold. I mean, I think, that's borne out by his career in MotoGP. But yeah, for whatever reason, they just nailed it all weekend, both of them. So yeah, impressive. But I do just wonder, Jim, just to sort of, you need to keep the drawer locked.
Oh, it is, flag, always.
But I do just wonder if this comment from Brivio about Joe Roberts might a hint at the fact that perhaps Oliveira and that Yamaha Pramac seat is a bit more to it than just pure rumour, despite the fact that I still think DiGiantonio would be a good slot in there. But anyway, I mean, again, speculating, we've already had that show. But Trackhouse, yeah, turned up, didn't they, this weekend?
They sure did.
Good to see.
It was good to see. Benyaya, again, yellow flags causing problems. He would be fourth. Alex Marquez, fifth. Morbidelli, sixth. Vignola, seventh. DiGiantonio, Bastianini, Acosta, tenth. But he's the fastest of all the KTMs. But again, KTM was nowhere this weekend. A very, very bad weekend, as we talked about earlier, with Pit Beyer defending the riders and whatnot.
And as we talked about some episodes ago, Pedro is crashing quite a bit. Now, whether that's just part of the going through the crashing phase or because he's pushing that bike a bit beyond what he's prepared to do at the moment because of the dip that they're taking. So interesting to see how they galvanize and come back from Silverstone onwards, because they have lost something.
Yes.
Doesn't take much.
No. So let's look at the sprint. At the start, Martin had the whole shot, then Benyaya led into turn one. So Benyaya had a great start with that. So he basically went from fourth to first. Ben Oliveira was there in second. Martin would fall back to third. Then there was Raul, Vinales, and Bastianini. Mark Marquez was 10th. Martin was by Oliveira to get to second. Then Martin was by at turn one, but he was wide, and Benyaya went back in front. Mark Marquez would be ninth. Then Martin finally, with third on two laps in, he finally got Benyaya at turn eight. Great move by Martin to get by at turn eight and hustle it to get there. So it was Martin, it was Oliveira, it was Benyaya, it was Bastianini, Vinales, and Raul. And then Benyaya had a track limits warning. So he had 12 laps left. He's going to have to deal with that limit warning. Basically, Martin pretty much is out front, got this. Oliveira's hanging in there for a second. But the real thing is trying to figure out like where Marquez is going to be. Like, so Marquez was seventh. He had gotten by Raul with six to go. Marquez, as in Mark, had a massive front end tuck, but he saved it. It looked like the old school Marquez on a Honda. The front end completely gone off the knee, the elbow, put it back on center, done. It was like, he even said, I can ride like Mark Marquez now. So any doubts of his surgery on his arm or his physical condition or anything else has kind of been tossed away. I think he's back. He just doesn't have a bike that's, again, competitive. It's a bike that is much more competitive than a Honda, but it is not the factory Ducati bikes, which he will earn, which he has done enough to earn that spot for next year. Acosta was off somewhere, had a trip through the gravel, and that put him back down to like somewhere around like 12th. But Martin would win the sprint, followed by Oliveira. So that's Trackhouse's first podium, if you will. I don't know if it's really a podium. It's a sprint. I don't know. It's their first silver medal. Is that what you say? I don't know.
I guess. Yeah.
You know, would finish third. Bastianini did provide us with some stuff at the end. Bastianini did run through the pack at the end to get a fourth. Then Morbidelli was fifth. Marquez was sixth. Vignale seventh, Binder eighth, and the last point scorer was Alex Marquez. And that was the sprint. Anything more for the sprint before we talk about the MotoGP race itself? Nope.
No, yeah. It was pretty boring, really. Bagnaia, by his own admission, was a bit overly conservative, protecting his tyre,
yep.
And then ran out of laps to do anything with the grip that he had at the end. So that was really it.
Mm, yep. So Martin gets out front from his pole position, followed by Oliveira, followed by Bagnaia, followed by Alex Marquez, Morbidelli, and Raul. Bagnaia had got himself to second. He got by Oliveira. Marquez was ninth. Bagnaia then got by Martin, which was interesting. Morbidelli got by Oliveira, and Mark Marquez was eighth. And it was all over the place in the first couple of laps here. I mean, the first five laps of this race were pretty spectacular. So Alex Marquez, he went to fourth because he actually got by Oliveira as well. So with 25 long laps to go of the Saxon Ring, Bagnaia is in front, followed by Martin, Morbidelli, Alex Marquez, Oliveira, Vinales, and Mark Marquez. So Martin then would get back by Bagnaia. Vinales had a great save at turn eight. With his Aprilia, he kind of lost it, picked it back up, got it. Then Martin was absolutely just inching away from Bagnaia, and Morbidelli got by Pecco for a little bit, but that got straightened back out again because a couple laps, took him about four laps, but Bagnaia righted the ship and got himself back past Morbidelli to be back into second. And I thought, wow, that's really it in the race, because I felt like at that point, Martin had this under control. He had a gap, and I didn't know if Bagnaia had enough fight in him to get back to the front, because, you know, now my mind's like really thinking like, what can Bagnaia do? Cause Morbidelli was kind of holding him up, and sure enough, he had his head down, and Bagnaia got right back to being within a second, 9/10, 8/10 of Martin. Alex Marquez got by Morbidelli, tongue tied there, folks. Sorry. Oliveira was gotten by two. So he was back to sixth. Now with 10 to go, it's Martin, Bagnaia, Alex Marquez, Morbidelli, Mark Marquez, and Bastianini. Again, the beast showing us he's great on tires, right? So here he is again. We got, you know, 10 laps to go, and he's at the front sniffing around for the podium spot. Morbidelli and Mark Marquez, they touch, and it's bucking Bronco again at turn one. And Marquez actually broke the screen on his Ducati. I think his arm went into it and cracked the glass. But again, it was one of those things that's where two different lines work, right? You can sort of do the V and come back, which is what Morbidelli was doing, or you can take the big arc through. And again, they just sort of showed up in the same piece of track at the same time. Stewards looked at it. They didn't do anything about it. I agree. Racing incident. It's just two guys I mean, we're hanging so far off the bike now, we're unsighted to our left. Marquez had no idea where Bedelli had went, to be honest. And they just wound up bumping into each other. But that got Marquez by Morbidelli. And so with five to go, it's still Martin, still Bagnaia. Now it's Alex Marquez, Mark Marquez, Morbidelli, and Bastianini. Then Bastianini gets by Morbidelli. But then Morbidelli goes back by again. This is the order kind of stays this way. And I'm thinking this is it. We're going to run out the rest of the race because everybody kind of seemed to be where they were. I think Bagnaia was still close. But Martin simply tucked the front and fell off with two laps to go at turn one. I was shocked that that happened. Were you like in, did you have like that moment, Rich, or what?
Well, standing out of my chair, punching the air kind of moment. I'm not the world's biggest Jorge Martin fan, it's true. Yeah, I mean, I was pretty gobsmacked, like I would imagine pretty much everybody, including Jorge Martin. Himself was really, he just has a bit of a habit of doing this in main races, doesn't he? He doesn't crash in the sprints. That's the interesting thing. And what I can't quite get my head around is that the sprints, which can be a bit crazy, but they've almost switched. The main races tend to be a bit more exciting than the sprints recently. And, you know, we've seen, Martin, I'm just going to think of a couple of examples, Jerez this year, and obviously, was it Thailand last year, Mandalika, I think, where he crashed out of the main race in, you know, a reasonably comfortable lead. I think Bagnaia just has managed to get himself into his head a little bit, into Martin's head, that is. And Martin just does have this habit of cracking under pressure. I don't know what else you can say, really, Jim, about it. But for me, I think we might reflect at the end of the season that this was the moment when Martin lost the championship, because I think this takes the wind out of the sails. He had a chance to abate the progress that Bagnaia has made over the last three or four rounds and kind of threw that away. Bagnaia is now 10 points to the good. He's got 3 weeks, Martin, to dwell on this bad error that he's made. And as you said, I think, you know, the grace and good favour from Ducati starts to ebb away. Pramac now, partly because Martin's going to Aprilia and Ducati don't want the number one plate on an Aprilia, but more so because Pramac go to Yamaha and Ducati specifically do not want new parts finding their way into the IP kind of sites of one of their main competitors. So I think all of these things together, plus the great run of form that Bagnaia is on, accepting that he lost the sprint, but he know why he lost the sprint. He didn't push hard enough early in the race and he admitted to the fact. So all of these things to me add up to the fact that that was a fatal error, really, by Jorge Martin. And I think he'll pay for that now in terms of the championship.
I completely agree with you because this was the wrong time to fall off a motorcycle. Now, there's never a good time, right? But in the scope of what was going on, you had, again, you're very correct. You had a chance to stop the momentum that Bagnaia had. You had a chance to get yourself settled. Go away onto summer break. Be like, hey, sit on the beach, relax. I'm leading the world championship. All is good. We'll come back and we're going to keep on going here, you know, and he didn't do it, right? He does seem to have a habit of cracking underneath these long races. He seems to make strategic errors that Bagnaia doesn't seem to make. I give you Phillip Island, although I love that gamble. I really loved that gamble with the tire, but it didn't work. But still,
it didn't work.
But I still loved it, but it didn't work. So, I mean, I'm not trying to pick the stuffing out of Martin. It just seems he seems to be prone to doing things that Bagnaia does not. This almost reminds me of Schwantz v. Rainey, where Schwantz is Martin. Okay, I'm winning. I'm just going to win so bad to make you feel so bad about yourself. I'm just going to demoralize you because I'm going to beat you on the racetrack. Whoop, threw it away and wadded it up into a ball. And Bagnaia is the Rainey type. Well, okay, if you're going to beat me today, I'm just going to go work harder during the week and come back next week, and I'm just going to beat you with a better setup. And it's kind of what happens. I mean, because, you know, regardless, though, of these two, is next year Marquez is not going to let you have a mulligan, especially when he's on a factory Ducati. That is the one thing. If you look at Marquez's championship seasons, he has always jumped on everybody's throat at the beginning of the year and ripped off a few wins and put everybody on the back foot to catch him. And it's, you know, we seem to have seen over these titles that Bagnaia has, and potentially this one too, he starts slow. He has to work his way into it. Like, he doesn't have the setting for the 24 bike exactly correct, but he's got it now. Well, you cannot give Marquez those first 4/5 races to do that. If you do, he's going to destroy you. Same thing with Martin, sort of, is the other way, right? He eventually starts kind of well, but eventually the pressure mounts on him and he collapses, which is weird. Because Martin is a Moto 3 world champion. And he did, but he was never a Moto 2 world champion.
Well, that doesn't mean, the KTM.
Right. It doesn't mean anything. But you have to kind of go, huh? I don't know. It just seems it's one something to think about. That's all I'm saying.
I think we're all guilty. I mean, Bagnaia, let's not forget. I mean, he had a habit. Certainly a couple of seasons ago, and when he first came into MotoGP, he did have a habit of tracking up the road at points when he didn't need to do.
Yeah.
If you remember that season when Quartararo won the championship, I remember at least two or three occasions when Pecco kind of crashed out of the lead.
Yeah, so I think Pecco had to learn how to win.
Riders do go through this, but the thing about Pecco, and I'm just thinking about next year with Marc Marquez, I mean, Marc Marquez is eminently capable of winning multiple titles on the Ducati. That's, you know, no doubt whatsoever. But I think we were all a bit guilty of underestimating just how stealthily good Bagnaia is, because he's very unflashy. You know, he's not very Italian, to be perfectly frank, and that's no insult. You know, he just gets his head down and gets on with it. And if he has a bad day, he explains why. He takes it on the chin and he holds himself accountable more often than not, as he indeed he did in the sprint race. You know, he said that was my fault. I just didn't push hard enough and I, you know, ran out of time to use the tyre and the grip that I had left. And, you know, he is becoming really formidable, that guy. And as you say, Jim, he gets stronger as the year goes on. And you can bet your bottom dollar that Delina will come with some parts in the second half of the season that Pramac won't get.
Oh, well, yeah, definitely.
Which is only going to make Martin's problem and challenge even bigger. So, yeah, away, and you know, they all crash. It's easy to crash. I mean, it was a very fast race. I mean, they were doing very, very quick laps all the way through. And Bagnaia, because he had saved his tyre, bearing in mind it was the longer race, and so he was edging closer, tenth by tenth, lap by lap. He was getting closer to Martin, who would have seen that on his pit board. And you're just tempted to say, just push that wee bit too much, and you've only got to be a couple of inches off the line, and you're down. And that's kind of what happened, didn't it? So, yeah, interesting way to head into the summer break. Bad for Martin, great for Bagnaia, who gets married, apparently. So that's kind of the best wedding present he could have given himself, isn't it?
Yep. So also on the second to last lap, Marquez, i.e. Mark, got by his brother Alex, who now those two are running in podium positions thanks to Martin's failure. And so it's Bagnaia winning. It's Mark Marquez, then Alex Marquez, then Bastianini, then Morbidelli, then Oliveira, then Acosta, who was nowhere and got himself to seventh, which showed that he's not given up and that he's still by far the best KTM rider, because Binder was ninth, two places behind him. And it was pretty impressive. So, Bezzecchi, Acosta 7th, Bezzecchi 8th, Binder 9th, then Raul Fernandez round out the top 10 on that. So interesting, we have brothers on the podium. Last time that happened, 1997 with the Aoki brothers, which was pretty crazy. It's been a long time since
Imola,
we had brothers.
Apparently, remember racing GP bikes at Imola?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that's... gives you how long ago it was.
Yeah, it's a pity we don't go there, but the walls are a wee bit too close there.
I'm surprised World Superbike goes there or did go there. and it's reconfigured state, to be quite honestly, because they have some weird chicane thing that they do by the pit lane or whatever. But that does shake up the championship, as you noted earlier, Rich. Benyaya now goes to 222 points. Martin was at 212 points going into that race because of his points he tallied in the sprint, which means that Benyaya takes a 20-point deficit and makes it a 10-point lead going in there. So quite a lot. Marc Marquez is now on 166 points in third, 56 behind. And then Bastianini, Vinales, Acosta is sixth. Binder, DiGiantonio, Aleix Espargaró, and Alex Marquez in the top 10. It is between Martin and Benyaya. And at this point, I think you might as well just hand the title to Benyaya, because I think we can all agree the new parts and pieces are going to go to Benyaya. They're not going to go to Martin, and they're not going to stay there. Now, what's going to be interesting to me is that, do you start to give Marc Marquez later development pieces for that, his 2023 bike? Because he starts out on his bike was essentially where the 2023 Ducati started in 2023. So there obviously are some development pieces that are sitting around somewhere. So I'm wondering if they're going to give him some development parts and pieces to kind of, you know, maybe make this a Ducati 1-2 in the championship kind of a thing, just to further annoy Martin, which him going to Aprilia is either going to do one of two things. He's either going to just ride like a madman just to annoy Ducati and be the pest, you know, the gnat, the fly that they can't swoosh away. Or he's going to go there and just wreck his brains out trying to beat the Ducatis. I'm not sure which way it's going to play out, but
I mean, he's kind of gone there under duress, really, hasn't he? Let's be honest. I mean, he got, you know, thrown under the bus, or the team truck, whatever you want to say, by Ducati again. In that sense, I do feel a little bit sorry for Jorge Martin, because he's done everything he could possibly have done to warrant getting the call up to the works team, but it hasn't worked out. I just simply think that next year Aprilia won't be in a position as a team, as an outfit, to win the championship. But having said that, I mean, Martin might do extraordinary things, but I just think probably it takes a wee bit longer to turn that into a winning machine. Now, whether Martin's the guy to do that mentally, I don't know. But I mean, to pick up on your point, I don't think Ducati really need to feed Marquez parts to sort of help out in the fight. I just think Bagnaia's got this now, because we've seen this the last two or three seasons. He just gets stronger and stronger. In the last two seasons, he's won by doing it that way. So I don't think he needs any help at this point.
I wasn't suggesting that Ducati give parts to Marquez to help Bagnaia. I just think, hey, help Marquez be second in the championship.
Yeah, well, I suppose, but in effect, they keep doing the same thing by helping Marquez out in that way. But I don't know. I don't think that's really the Ducati way. I don't think they're going to run interference. I mean, we had this discussion in the last episode, I think. But, it just looks bleak going forward, I think, for Martin from here, really.
Yeah.
Psychologically more than anything else. I just think it's such a body blow to have thrown that win away. I think he'll struggle to get over that for a while.
I agree with you, Rich. I was just looking quickly. I was trying to think of where Mazzano is in the schedule. Because we are at, if I could scroll faster. So we just got done with that. So we go to the British Grand Prix at Silverstone. And then, then we have a 2-week break to go to, or weekend off, if you will. We go then to the Red Bull Ring. And then we go to Aragon at that weekend of August 30th to September 1st. Then we go to San Marino in September. So definitely that gives us 1, 2. So we have only 3 races before we get to where I guarantee you Martin will not be getting any new parts, because that the 13th race there is, that's, they're not going to.
And there's a test, I think, at Misano straight after the race, isn't there? So, yeah.
Yep. And then, I don't know, I guess, are we going to Kazakhstan? Yes, no. I'm thinking no.
I think probably not.
Yeah, I think not. But that's supposed to be after the Misano test. It's supposed to be Kazakhstan and then Indonesia, whatever. Anyway, definitely there's only like, you know, if Martin has any hope, he's got to have to put together at least two wins in these next three races if he wants to maintain the championship. If Banyaya takes 3 of 3, or if Martin, you know, who knows, somebody else could win. But if Martin is not on the podium or anywhere near it, it's done. And in fact, this might be the first of the nail in the coffin that is the championship or championship defeat for Martin. So anyway, that is it, Rich. I don't have anything else that I would like to discuss about the race, unless you have something that I may have missed.
No, the only thing I was going to mention, Jim, just before we scootle off to bed and dinner and one thing and another, depending on our time zones, is to say Donington Park this weekend. World Superbikes, really excited for that. Hopefully get some good chats in the bag there. And earlier today, I put out 773, which was the chat with Jamie Van Sekelris from Tag Racing Honda at Snetterton last weekend. I'm sure people will listen to it. But yeah, if you haven't listened to what you weren't going to, I would encourage you to do so, because he's a very interesting, I was going to say young man. I feel like a bit of a pleb saying that, really. But I am, 50, what are we now, Jim? 52?
52.
I think, is it? Yeah, bloody hell. So he is a young man compared to me. But yeah, very interesting guy, very humble, honest, brutally honest in actual fact. So really insightful conversation. Definitely a few areas that we're going to pick up and talk about again. And we've put a few, Jamie did actually share some x-rays of his legs with some of the procedures that he's put himself through, which we, with his permission, I'll just hastily add, put out on the Instagram feed the other day. If you haven't, listeners, if you haven't subscribed to the Instagram MotoPod feed, please do so. Because the more people we can get on that, the better as well. And you will pick up content like that. I'll be posting some pictures from Donington. I'll be obviously be putting pictures on from Silverstone MotoGP in a couple of weeks' time. And the more we can do, the better it is for everybody, hopefully. So please do head over to X, Instagram, Threads, if you're one of the few people that appear to use that seriously. And subscribe, please, because it really does help us. But yeah, listen to the chat if you can with Jamie, because really interesting guy, I thought. And he was very open and honest with us, which is always nice, because riders often don't want to give away too much. It's part of the mental makeup, part of the defense system, and not letting competitors of theirs and stuff kind of know too much. Whereas he was rather different. So it was an interesting take, I think. And you enjoyed listening to it in the car on your way home. Early gym, so yeah, that's everything for me.
All right, so with that, folks, we'll close this show out, and I'll remind you all to ride safe.
See you next time.